she writes about Joan's writing, and she has this lovely quote about your writing, and she says that it's effect of these capacious concepts of doing art and living in the world by engaging positively with otherness and unintelligibility with the as of yet unknown or invisible have sustained me as they have many others, end quotes. It's just really beautiful. And so we'll hear more from Evelyn of how she's been informed by Joan's work. And also the wonderful Erica Kaufman, who's very much a good friend of ours and a part of the feminist avant-garde lineage, and will speak to also the deep influence of Joan's writing and friendship on her own work. And I just want to take a moment to say that Erica's participation in this event is particularly really important because it signifies what Marcella and I hope is our ultimate hope in this book, which is to further honor and archive these important dialogues within the feminine avant-garde and also the profound relationships that have manifested from them. So thank you for being here tonight. And I just want to take a couple minutes to give you, who are those of you who might not be familiar with the collection, other influences, a little bit of background about the book, hopefully enticing you to read it. Much of the book highlights women's creative friendships, the communities they have fostered, that often are erased or, as we know, like relegated as merely social. So we all know that these are relationships are also historical, political, theoretical, and fundamental to developing generative, lasting lineages. And so I want to say a little bit about my friendship with Marcella, who I've just been really happy and honored to work with on this project, and just really briefly say that we met in the early 2000s as poets judging applications for a writing residency. And we immediately connected in our mutual taste for the so-called difficult work, which the other people on the board thought, you know, wasn't good enough, up to snuff, or wasn't really poetry. And so that work, of course, included work submitted by feminist avant-garde poets whose work, you know, did not fit into the conventional categories. So we became fast friends from that, and then moving quickly forward, 2014, I teach the New School. I was developing a course called Feminist Avant-Garde Poetics, and I invited Marcella to be a guest teacher and collaborator in this course. We made this decision, which turned out to be really key, that instead of instructing students about the lineage of each studied poet in the course, that we would instead invite poets to create what we call influence packets. And they were these handmade packets where they got to crack open the word influence and include not only poets that inform their work, but scientists, artists, musicians, and et cetera. And from there, we would read the poet's work along with their influence packets, and the poets would come to the class and there would be these amazing generative conversations from that. From that moment of teaching these influence packets, it pretty much took off. We were influenced by the enthusiasm of the students and the writers who visited the class, and then we decidedly opened up these handmade packets outward to more explicitly mark the existence of this other lineage, and that was the evolution of this book. We invited each of the poets who visited the class to write original essays about their own context and inspiration and the various ways they themselves align with the feminist avant-garde. So that gives you a little like, kind of sense of what the book is about. I'm gonna invite Marcella up in a second, but I just wanna end with a quick quote. This event is kind of full circle for me because I co-edited another anthology, and I think I'm done at this point, but that was in the early 2000s, and it was called Letters to Poets, Conversations about Poetics, Politics, and Community with Dana T. Lomax. And the reason why I bring this up is because Joan Retallack was in this book corresponding for over a year's time, and Karen Weiser, who's also here, was in this book, over a year's time with the poet Brenda Ajima. And it was this really amazing correspondence. And I want to read just a quick quote from the first letter that Joan sent to Brenda. It's the very end of her letter. This is 2005. And you can see how much what she's saying really resonates with what's happening right now. A noticing, questioning, inventing of constructive ways of being a non-destructive part of our world is essential to my mind to combat conservative smugness and the destructiveness that comes out of the greed for my security, my nostalgia, my preferred stability. Living in mutual acknowledgement and respect for others is not a simple I, thou, aha, as one can see all too well in the Middle East. It requires the invention of new ways of being together, new forms of life, as Wittgenstein puts it, new language games. Marcella Durand.
Right, which is an amazing book. Also, I just want to point out that There are many rare copies of Joan's books over there, so I fully I encourage you to go have a book buying frenzy over there and there, which is where other influences is being sold to. So please buy books. Then we're each going to read a poem from this copy of Bosht, which is also for sale. So we're each going to read one poem from that. We're going to move into a short roundtable to talk about friendship, influence, sharing each other's work, and then we're going to segue to kind of audience engagement with this roundtable. So the roundtable is going to slowly move outward and invite you all into it, and then afterwards there will be some signed books too by whoever you would like to sign a book. So, all right, thank you all, and so Erica.
I don't think I need to.
Okay.
So, I have the great honor and pleasure of reading a short selection from some of Joan's more recent work, particularly a poem that's called Polities and or Sonnets, 63 Enigmatic Quatrains, 21 Stealth Couplets, and I'm not going to read all of these enigmatic quatrains, but I'll read a few. 1.1. The last interview, a stranger in my own country, linguistics, why it matters, classics, why it matters, art, why it matters, wonder beyond belief, upheaval, the refugee trek through Europe, God is beautiful, state of emergency, I am not a brain, why the world does not exist, or worse, formations of the unconscious talking to a brick wall. 1.2. The quantified self on the names of the father, thinking in cases, I know how many of you there are. The true life, our wound is not so recent, in praise of mathematics, in praise of theater, black, the brilliance of a non-color, metamorphosis of the world. What is to be done? The new French philosophy, figures of history, jealousy. Excuse me 1 second. Point 3. On love, the method of equality, the politics of literature, aesthetics and its discontents. What happened in the 20th century? The aesthetic imperative, saving beauty, selected exaggerations. What is power? The scent of time, rape and resistance, the expulsion of the other, human dignity. Who is Charlie? 1.4. The feminine subject, dispossession, the post-human, are we all post-racial yet? The future of whiteness, freedom to fail, an imaginary racism, the fanaticism of the apocalypse, a biography of ordinary man, general theory of victims, intellectuals in power, the insurrection of the victim. Why philosophize? Classification struggles. 1.5. Clint Eastwood's America, Spike Lee's America, Alfred Hitchcock's America, Steven Spielberg's America, Martin Scorsese's America, Foucault now, Derrida now, Rancière now, Nancy now, xenofeminism, narco-capitalism, ascendancy of finance, PlayStation, dream world, persons and things. 2.1.1. Manufacturing happy citizens, or the last interview, white privilege, or a stranger in my own country. What dogs can teach us about the good life, or linguistics, why it matters. The lure of technocracy, or classics, why it matters. Love, power, and knowledge, or art, why it matters. Lectures on negative dialectics, or wonder beyond belief. The future of feminism, formations of the unconscious. Thank you, Joan.
Broadcasting to the room, it's going to the radio.
Oh, well,
so it's a matter of the sound level on the computer.
That matters. Thank you.
Thank you. So when I think about Joan's influence in the context of my life, I think of two related but somewhat different Joan Retallicks. The first is Joan Retallick, the brilliant essayist and poet whose influence has been deep and significant for me, even though when I read much of her work, I didn't know Joan at all. And the second is my friend Joan, who I got to know significantly later in life, and who's been a wonderful presence and also a role model for me as both a writer and a person. So I thought I'd start by talking about the first Joan Retallick, especially the writer of the essays in The Poetic Wager, whose influence has been widespread, and whose concept of poetics, a term which she coined and defined, has moved into the conversation of poets and scholars to the extent that it's become part of the general vocabulary, even to the point of sometimes being used without attribution to her, a very mixed sort of homage, but a homage nonetheless. So in connection with today's event, I thought I would read a few passages from a few of the essays in Poetical Wager. And I chose these because I thought they exemplify the inventiveness of the way she used and continues to use the essay form, her advocacy of experimental or avant-garde writing, and as an extension of that, her concept of the experimental feminine as an element of anti-patriarchal poetics and a mode of writing available to people of all gender identifications. And just before I read these passages, just to remind a reminder that The Poetical Wager was actually published in 2003, but of course many of the essays were written earlier and published in various places. So I'm just pointing that out because I think as I read, you'll find yourself noting just how prescient and relevant all of this is. So this is from The Experimental Feminine. And the first sentence, it starts with a reference to the Odyssey. In the usual allocation of conceptual labor, the fantasy past, Penelope, is feminine, and history, Odysseus, is masculine. Let's imagine another version. Is it that the probable is masculine, the improbable feminine? But the swerve always, the Lucretian, Epicurean, Joan. The swerve that brings on possibility must be hermaphrodite, androgyne, mongrel, cyborg, queer, lovely freak, the unintelligibility that reveals life continuing as continuing surprise. Are there piquant unintelligibilities that draw curiosity toward possibility? Eve is the prototype of the experimental feminine. Her inquisitiveness, her desire to try something new, frees the virtual couple from their virtual paradise. A new, complex, realist story has been ready to begin for a very long time. And this next one is also from the same essay. Any truly contemporary art is experimental because to be actively engaged with one's contemporariness is to be in conversation with the unintelligible. Too often, critics who would be the first to agree that nothing can be created ex nihilo reflexively dismiss these conversations as spurning tradition. Although every generation faces problems unknown to previous ones,
Artists are artists because they have loved the work of artists before them. They spend their lives in conversation with the dead as well as with the living. As well as with what they know they don't know in both terror and wonder. The present is what we, in the urgency of the unprecedented, with the pressures of rapid-fire transformations all around us, make of the past. And of course, it's what the past has made of us. The contemporary is no more or less than a further complication of history that makes experiment as critical dialogue with history the poetical enactment of optimism. It asks, despite pressures to hunker down and minimize risks, what's possible? It's amazing. It's not surprising how unsettling that question can be. I've got just a few more of these. This is from the Scarlet H.
Yes.
We speak of a static binary, but are those tensely positioned pairs ever really so still? The feminine and masculine are much more convincing as migratory principles that in principle can work in any body, can be engaged by anyone in multivariable proportions. Among other things, this means women / men don't have to parody or subvert or steal power from one another to liberate the self, because the other is already part of the self. Acknowledged or not, each of us carries, as inoculation and disease, an internally embedded reciprocal alterity. She's really just a remarkable, rigorous writer. One from Rethinking Literary Feminism. I'd like to suggest that it is a women's feminine text, denying any redundancy, that implicitly acknowledges / creates the possibility of other / additional / simultaneous texts. This is a model significantly different from Bloom's competitive anxiety of influence. It opens up a distinction between the need to imprint / impress one's mark on the other, and an invitation to the other's discourse as necessary to an always collaborative making of meaning. Collaboration with the reader is unnecessary only when meaning is being reported rather than made. Then I'm just going to read one more from a later essay called What is Experimental Poetry and Why Do We Need It? And I'm going to read this because I think it shows how the idea of poetics just easily, it's so useful, it expands into many other arenas of writing and thinking. Suppose a loose affiliation of we's were particularly concerned right now to invite parts of the world previously excluded into the operational purview of our poetics, somehow on their own terms. Suppose poets began to operate under the rubric eco-poetics with the aim of developing a body of work that reinvestigates our species' relation to other inhabitants of the fragile and finite territory our species named, claimed, exploited, sentimentalized, and aggrandized as our world. Those others have been faithfully excluded from a review of our intentions, but not from their consequences. That is, they, trees, birds, other animals, grasses, rivers, experience but cannot imagine us. We imagine but too often do not really experience them. Then I'm just going to finish. I want to say a few words about what I value so much in having Joan as a friend. And I think others in this room will recognize just about all of this. Her earnest and truly reciprocal engagement as a conversationalist, which I think is a rare quality, actually. And so I feel incredibly fortunate to be able to spend so much time at her kitchen table in dialogue. It's really been wonderful. Her exuberant, ongoing love of poetry. Part of being in her house is also always to be looking at a changing arrangement of books she's excited about.
that have been alluringly laid out on the tables and shelves around you. Her inspiration is a role model for work, as a person who's so deeply committed to her writing that pretty much she's working full time during the week, and it's best not even to try to see her except in the late afternoon or weekends. And her fundamental, I was going to say optimism, but it's not that exactly, but rather joy in writing and living. Only very recently she was telling me that to be writing, she needs to be able to connect to a state of pleasure or delight. She may have even said laughter, and I often picture her at her desk writing and laughing. So I'm just going to stop there and say how fortunate many of us are to have Joan as an ongoing influence in our lives and writing. And I'll turn things over to Erica.
Thank you. Thank you so much to Marcella and Jennifer and Evelyn and, of course, Joan. It's such a privilege and honor to be having this conversation. And as I'm sitting here, it occurs to me that, I'm having memories of when I met each of you. And Marcella, I remember when we sewed Anatomy of Oil, a chapbook of yours we put out many years ago now. And that connects to, I have a lot to say about Joan, so I'm going to try and prioritize letting her language speak for itself. But just as a way of framing, the first time I met Joan Retallack in person was when I invited her to read for Belladonna, which I co-curated and co-edited with Rachel Levitsky until 2010. The event took place on September 3rd, 2004, and it was the first reading of our fifth anniversary. I paired Joan with Latasha N. Nevada Diggs. The reading took place at the Siebel Theater in the CUNY Graduate Center, where I would actually begin my PhD a few years later. Joan's chaplet, Belladonna number 64, and what's amazing is that there are 342 Belladonna chaplets now, so Joan was 64, was titled The Reinvention of Truth. Yesterday, I revisited my introduction to Joan, which I gave then, and in it, I focused on her use of the procedure in Errata Suite as a way to open up space for thinking that is both unpredictable and potentially and importantly expansive. In that introduction, I began with a quote from Barbara Guest's essay, Wounded Joy, in which Guest talks about the importance that the poem reaches beyond the page somehow. I remember my excitement at that time, now over 20 years ago, because it was a moment when I was trying to figure out the kinds of containers that would enable me to do things through language that I would find surprising. I'm somebody who really likes puzzles and questions and kind of, playing around with things. Joan's work was revelatory for me, as was Maggie O'Sullivan's. In Joan's poetry, I saw a way of approaching the making of the poem that embodied what I was thinking about, ways of intentionally experimenting with language in order to evoke or interrogate change. And I'm going to pause and just read a very short quote from a conversation between Joan and Tina Dara, whom Marcella mentioned. And this is from Ariel number 5, which came out in 1991. And they're talking about some of Tina's writing, and Joan says, "It seems also that the idea that structures make certain things possible, which wouldn't be possible in the absence of those structures, is a central assumption among avant-garde artists as well as scientists." So these ideas about thinking about how we make things and what the questions are that drive us to make things out of language was enormous for me as a young person kind of finding my way in my own poetry and in my own thinking as a human being, to be honest. I did not read The Poethical Wager until it came out in book form some years later. But when I did, it felt as though I found a kindred spirit mentor. Joan puts into language many of the things I was feeling and still feel in the embodied sort of way, but that I myself had not actually figured out how to articulate. So what I wanted to do was to read a series of excerpts from a 2021 interview called Experimental Writing and Beyond. And it's an interview with Joan done by Jan Batens for the magazine Place, and it's available online. And given that I've always been deeply interested in procedure and chance, and Joan's deep inquiry into what it means ethically, politically, poetically, poethically to work in and through these modes has had an indelible impact on my own compositional processes. So what I've done is I've made selections from this particular interview that hopefully echo, relate to, correspond with what Evelyn was reading from the Poethical Wager. And again, the Poethical Wager actually was what I ended up writing my dissertation on in many ways. You know, my experience with the thinking that happens in the Poethical Wager, which you hear being continued, expanded upon, complicated, in the excerpts I'll read, it really became a life-saving kind of grounding for me as far as not just the way I thought or the way that I wrote and continue to write, but also what I do with my life. Like I, you know, I work at Bard College because I Googled poets who teach writing but not creative writing and the language and thinking program came up, and I clicked on the link and Joan Retallick was the director of said program. I applied, I taught in it, and I am now the director of that program. So when I say that Joan's impact on me is very multifaceted and kind of hard to be brief about, I mean it in a lot of different ways. So I'll read a few passages from this more recent interview, and you'll notice that I'm just gonna, as a way to mark the jumping around that's gonna happen, I'll repeat the very start of each passage, so you'll know that I'm skipping stuff. Two major realizations. Two major realizations ultimately healed the seeming dichotomy between formal considerations and socio-political content. The first was beginning to invent procedures. For many, procedures are a way to avoid emotional or socio-political content. For me, they are a way of incorporating it. The other was the realization that everything we create aesthetically, that is, every act of poesis, enacts an ethos. What was my ethos? It had to do with what I consistently deeply cared about, in a nutshell, social justice. But I didn't want to give up formalist perspectives that add the important dimension of undecidability, which lets the reader collaborate in meaning making. Procedures make that possible. Can one make a case for experimental procedures that take us beyond? Can one make a case for experimental procedures that take us beyond self-reflective mirror of nature renderings that must always foreground our human subjectivity? One possibility is to create a poetics empathically tutored by what John Cage called nature's own manner of operation, which, with ever-increasing technical and scientific knowledge, equips us to transform our contemporary awareness of nature's manner of operation into art. With such an approach, one may release the constructive powers implied in alterity's cognates: alter, alteration, alternative. Alterity is always entangled in a degree of complexity that involves both extreme gravitas and profound humor. The work of Hieronymus Bosch, which I greatly admire, is deeply permeated by that. It is a visual and ethical starting point for my latest volume of poetry titled Bosch. It's my opinion that mere stylistic oddities will never be odd enough, particularly not if one wants to somehow invite an exploration of alterity into the linguistic action of the work, demonstrating how material dynamics, latristic, linguistic, spatial, temporal, may even illuminate the generative alterity of the genre itself. Borrowing from procedural methodologies, devising procedures to be enacted by vocabularies and latristic logics begins with questions I want to explore in a poetic context and must admit on the scale of the poem, some aspect of complexity and indeterminacy of every phenomenon touching our lives. That means, as John Cage developed it, kinds of precision that admit chance in what chaos theorists have called pattern-bounded indeterminacy. I first encountered this approach to aesthetic composition in Cage's rigorous chance operations. As for the scope and limits of all this, I feel that's largely determined by my choices, which are themselves determined by the nature of my interests, the nature of the puzzle I'm addressing, often something I'm also thinking through in essay form or in my visual work play. In any case, what for me constitutes an experiment of any kind is interrogatively driven from beginning to end, a poetical wager. Caring is most effective. Caring is most effective when it brings ethos and logos into practices where our cultures, embedded as they are in our common ecosphere, are recognized as crucial moving parts in the material context on which every creature on Earth depends. I consider this true for any kind of constructively meaningful poetics. Acts of compositional poiesis apply to any material, but for purposes of my projects, language, numerals, symbolic logics, experimental design, visual constructions, performance. There are, of course, many forms of experimentation in the sciences, even within a given field. Still, one can identify a basic approach that begins with a compelling question, continues with a precisely designed interrogative procedure, guided by repeatedly asking, what happens now if we do this? The doing of the this is the key. In a literary context, these must be linguistically enacted inquiries. Altogether, a minimal but fair description of what's known as scientific method is just this, a procedural strategy activated by a question. Or, another way to put it, carrying out an experimental design from one initiating question to another. And I just want to read a poem from this marvelous book, which will come back into print in the very near future through Litmus Press. And one of the things, I mean, I love all of Joan's books, but this is a book full of questions and puzzles that are challenging and joyful and hilarious and dire. So this is a poem called September 29th, 1993. She is wearing the mind inside out. On parole, colon, oh, yes, yes, I was transported. The errors of medieval times become the language of romance. Among my dog's pleasures, to get very hot lying in the sun, then to lie in the shade and get very cool.
Designed to perceive most of what surrounds us or to fully understand the rest. Maybe its true nonlinear equations drove the teenager off the road. The self-propagating slope remains unhindered in its XY axis. It's always difficult to state these things rigorously. Sound waves break on the shore, making some feel unwelcome. And two, there's that conspicuous absence of real metaphor in nature. Sorry, I think I meant to say there's that conspicuous absence of real nature in metaphor. Someone will claim real is a misleading construct. Someone will claim night flew into a tree. Those five words in a line.
The magic rule of nine. Your sonic suit will never be a perfect fit. You'll learn to get by. Just don't assume all art is all about victory over death all the time. Not to say the meantime isn't as good a time as any to enjoy not being dead. In the swell of many a meantime, many have diverted themselves with great success. Hence civilization's discontents and greatest hits. Take, for instance, the magic rule of nine, that the sums of all numbers within the sums of all multiplicands of nine up to and including nine equal nine. One times nine equals nine. Nine equals nine. Two times nine equals 18. One plus eight equals nine. Three times nine equals 27. Two plus nine equals nine, etc. This is numerically melodious. Bird sings in tree. To the species that longs for more than a first glance affords. Someone will say, if you really think this is magic, you don't properly understand the decimal system. Bird falls out of tree. So great to have that listening. Who among us doesn't long for magic? Who among us truly understands the decimal system?
The long and short of it thought experiment. Feed long and short pigeons the same food, same food. Exercise long and short-legged quadrupeds in the same manner, same manner. Expose long and short-haired sheep to the same climate, climate. Direct every timeline toward the same set of nesting horizons. How long can the we and the they go on this way? One step takes longer than anyone thought possible and is still hovering in the air. Its shadow is swelling with prophecy and indecision. Earth is growing hotter and colder, wetter and drier. All the animals are on the move. Although the heart of the cruelty continues to elude our metrics, let any long or short lifespan equal exactly the same function of X divided by the violence of zero. You'll notice that the math is adding up to an old geometry of the tragic spectrum. More the terror, less the pity. Is that the long and short of it?
Elliptical ice terriers. Just as your blades describe an icy metaphysic of parallel curves, I will be your personal pronoun for the duration of this sentence. You will be my personal pronoun for the duration of this sentence. It's all about remaining in motion. Exquisite poetries and theories of everything propel flying spins. No hands bicycle arias on the way home. More reciprocal alterity, more biomimicry, less blood sausage fealty, explosions of sweetest beauty. My child, why repeat what some poet or another has already said? We live our lives forever taking leave, when a custom fitted speech act can be yours within 24 hours. With it, you can perform rites and ceremonies, weddings, baptisms, extreme unctions, forgiveness of sins, funerals, visit correctional facilities, start your own church.
So we're going to move to the round table, which will evolve into to audience Q&A. Joan, just thank you so much. I don't know if you wanted to.
Joan, would you like to join us?
To join you? You mean up there?
Is it you?
No, I feel I am situated in the most perfect way. And I have to say, this is just extraordinary. And you are such beautiful people.
And we're under a beautiful influence. I think I'd like to start by asking, in the context of your own work doing this, how, maybe with a specific example or two of a poem that you feel you have carried out doing this within the poetical context, if there's particular or even forthcoming work that you feel is carrying forward your, in the context of your friendship and also your knowledge of Joan's work, if there's a procedure you're carrying it out, or you have a interrogative question in your mind with some work that you're currently doing. So,
you mean about our own work?
Yes, your own poetry.
Probably lots of different examples, but I think I have been showing Joan manuscripts of mine in recent years, which is really wonderful. She can also be a critic. She's an incredibly honest person, so that comes, you know, that comes with a trust over time, actually. But there's, for me, I think there's a strain of my work that maybe her work gave me the courage to do, and that's what I consider kind of a blend of poetry and essay. And I think of them as poem essays, and I've just let myself be more discursive and not even worry about those boundaries whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And I think also she gives permission to be intellectual. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to be pompous about that, but to introduce all kinds of language that maybe others would think, well, that's not poetry. I mean, that general question that you guys brought up, that's not poetry. Mm-hmm. And she reads them with, you know, just such an engagement and appreciation. I think a lot of people get that from her. And I don't know that I would have gone that far without her as an influence over a long period of time.
For me, my first book, which I wrote like probably around 2004, so like right when I was beginning to know Joan, was procedurally driven, but it lacks a question. And the work that I've been doing since that book is completely driven by a question that really matters a lot to me. And you know, the procedure, my understanding of what it means to work procedurally has changed a great deal, because, you know, the procedure is only helpful in that it enables one to explore the question in ways that are unpredictable and surprising. So that's kind of a little bit of a vague answer, but I would say that I'm hopefully finishing very soon the third book in this trilogy that I've been writing, that are essentially revisionings or queerings of canonical texts, all epic texts. And Joan has been my interlocutor. Like, it's quite frequent that I'm like, I don't know what's happening, can I read this? And you know, I feel as though having somebody to talk to, not just about the nuts and bolts of the poem, but also some of the ideas that I'm grappling with. The book that I'm trying to finish now is trying to figure out a rewriting of Dante's Inferno that I think of as a translation, but it's a little bit different than translation. And
you know, there are certain ways that I tend to write that I would call procedural, but they all, none of it is detached from the self, which I think is something that can get lost in certain kinds of procedural work, where you do the thing and then the poem happens and there's a bit of distance from the person who's making the poem. But for me, because of the weight of the question that I'm asking myself, and you know, I feel a certain urgency with the material I'm working through, it ends up being a very different process.
I think another question I have is, in Joan's work, I'm interested in the interplay between abstraction and figuration. And that ties into eco-poetics too, is that you talk about fractals and the coastline of poetry. And just, if you find in your own work that you move between abstracting from, say, the real, or go beyond ekphrasis and kind of abstracting from art, just how that interplay works. If that's a, I know that's just something I think about a lot, so I'm not, and Joan's work in a way has given me permission to think about structure abstractly, almost the procedural. Like, I think we're using kind of different words here a little bit, like procedural, I think a little bit as structure too, and just how a poem is structured abstractly, maybe. So,
well, for some reason, I was just thinking as you were talking about the relationship between how procedure makes formalism fertile. Because, I mean, this is coming from Joan, but you know, formalism in itself can be very static producing. But how do you create a formalism that helps you be creative while still, and procedure is one of those ways. There's multiple ways, but procedure, like in your work, really is become a deep part of your creative process. You know, in terms of abstraction, or, you know, to me, fractal is related a little bit to scale. And one of the challenges of any eco-poetic work, as you know, Marcella, is scale is a bit, you know, it's kind of writing nature poetry at scale and under crisis. Mm-hmm. And the scale shifts are really important. So how do you manage those? And part of that is allowing yourself a kind of abstraction. Or Joan's written about a planetary imagination. What in the world is a planetary imagination? But it is something we have, and then one can write. So that's not really an answer, it's kind of just juxtapositions of thinking about these different things.
I mean, my brain actually goes to teaching. You know, a lot of the work that I've been doing for the past 10 years or so is a direct extension of the training that I had with Joan when I first began to teach in the Language and Thinking program at Bard College, which is a particular kind of pedagogy in and of itself that's writing-based and interdisciplinary. And I will never forget, during that training, one of the texts that we were reading together was by Mandelbrot, and it was about fractals. And it was, you know, it was a moment where, like, all of my insecurities were, like, front and center, because I was like, I don't understand this. I'm terrible at math and science. How am I gonna make sense of this? But the way that we were invited in the space of this training or workshop, which mirrors what happens with students, was to kind of entertain a response to that kind of abstraction. So to figure out how to really grapple with and interrogate abstraction instead of kind of being afraid of it or feeling as though it was something that one had to navigate around, it felt much more like an invitation to kind of live inside of the difficult thing, and that's something that's reverberated out for me. I definitely think about that in my own writing, but it's, you know, I teach I teach poetry now, and it's something I talk a lot about with my students. Like, we talk a lot about, you know, poetic form, you know, abstraction, and, you know, how to make a poem do the things that we want it to do in order to be alive.
I love that description, how to live inside the difficult thing, right? But also how to find joy and make the difficult thing kind of alive and dance, right? Which is another one, I think, of Joan's abilities, is to take the difficult thing, make it enact on an aesthetic, joyful level, too. So I'll ask one more question and then throw it open to the audience. I also am just interested in the philosophical side of this. It's entering art with a question. And you just said you didn't have an answer, but different juxtapositions. And I thought that was really interesting, because when you say I'm entering the poem with a question, then really what's the answer you're expecting to get, right? So I wonder if you can talk about that in your... And I love that we're not talking about writing processes. I get up in the morning and I have a cup of coffee and I write every day. I love that we're talking about the same role, you know.
I'm not sure about that, but as we were talking, I was thinking about, even about abstraction, the math in the sections we read from Bosch, all of them, which seems very Joan to me, and I know that Joan understands all the math. But
of course
you do. But, you know, I think there's something tied to pleasure. Like, poets can just take pleasure in abstract language almost just for the pleasure of it, or the math. There's something about the feeling tone around abstract languages. And I think that it's wonderful to let yourself have that, even if you feel at sea. You know, I've been writing about crazily ambitious stuff like the physics of time, you know, which sounds so incredibly ponderous, until I let myself enjoy the pleasure of the language. And I feel like maybe I get glimpses of understanding, and then it's okay, because that's part of what poets do. And since we're going to turn it to the audience, I'm just going to say that I want to say one other thing, which is that, you know, the idea of generation is strange. I don't even know if we're all the same generation. You know, we're kind of like, it's elastic, right? You know? But I know that people of our age, women of our age, we just have these brilliant essayists in our formative years. Joan, Rachel Duplessis, Susan Howe. You know, I don't even know what we would have done without them. I mean, I think, you know, there's the poetry, which is wonderful and great and beautiful, but sometimes you need that support of someone really writing their best, most thoughtful and thought-provoking prose to really feel supported in your art. And I just think it's astonishing. And I'm sure that I just missed some other brilliant essays that we have. But I think it's interesting how important the essay really is. And Joan's just a giant contributor to that. And I know she's finishing a new book of essays. So that's, we're going to have that.
It will be a miracle.
Oh, I don't know. So that's just a thank you.
Yeah. I just want to follow up and say that I totally yes to what you're saying, Evelyn, and just what you said in the first part of the roundtable, that it, for me, your work has opened up what the essay form could be, the capaciousness of it, because coming from the five paragraph essay, very, you know, directed and dead, and also being very interested in pedagogy as you are, I think it was you, I'm pretty sure, I remember listening to some recording of you talking about, like, working through the class as if you're working through an essay, where, like, a whole semester as an essay. And I think about this often, because it was like starting with a class with a question, with a generative collective question, and then like as paragraphs, each class would be building and meandering and hybridic. And it helped me not just with my poetry, but with my teaching. You know, I run a pedagogy program at the school too, and it's like, it just, it's like, it's not just me being like, this is what I think. It's like, actually, here are the questions that we can all generate, not answers to, but other questions and you know, turns for it. So, yes, thank you. Yeah.
Should we open?
Yeah, so we'll open and expand the round table outwards. Jeffrey?
Okay. A word that has come up, and I think with each of you, is permission.
Mm.
And you were just speaking about essays. And you know, when we talk about Joan, we want to talk like Joan. So, of course, essay means to try. And you just spoke about the five-paragraph essay, which can be trying. There you go. Gift to you. But in terms of giving permission, which I think each of you to talk about in terms of Joan and maybe a mentorship and teaching, I'm just curious to stick with essay about the importance, perhaps, or the tool of giving permission in enacting a fluidity between essay, poetry, and also, just to add a part B, if you feel that this tool or act of permission is a gendered thing.
So, Evelyn, you've been working on Evelyn and I just attended the Association for the Study of Literature and the Environment. And what was so interesting is that Joan's name kept coming up in different contexts of people presenting essays, presenting papers, writing talks. And I know that there's a whole thing we can talk about the difference. But Evelyn's presentation was a mix. You had described it as meant to be an aesthetic poem essay. So I think, permission is, I mean, that's a really loaded question. I'm not even really sure how to go there. It's true, I'm trying to imagine a male-identified poet talking about being given permission, because it's not something we culturally think about too often, right? And I'm in this identity here, so I'm not sure I can step outside of that to say if that's something. I mean, I don't know if you see.
Well, if you expanded the concept of the experimental feminine, which I don't always feel I totally, it's very, I can get this wrong when I'm speaking, but it's really about the element of exploratoriness, about exploring apparent silences that shouldn't be silent, about letting oneself swerve into improbability, and that she always says is available to artists of all gender identifications, because it's really saying that there's something about people with please, Joan, I would love to be corrected, but you know, if people have experienced, you know, histories of suppression, there's silences to unwrap, and part of that is maybe permission's just in the vocabulary, trying to talk about that, and feeling free to speak things that maybe didn't seem in the mainstream of dignity, genius, problematic word. I think that suppresses a lot of people, creativity. And so somewhere in there, there's a gender, the way she speaks of gender is very, actually unique in that way. That it's really about the embrace of those elements of life and writing that absolutely everyone can tap into.
Douglas?
Well, to speak to the question of a male writer, who do you feel the need to be granted permission, or do you get permission? I think anybody writing in or creating in an avant-garde tradition always has that question of, like, can I do this? And then you you encounter another avant-garde artist who had gone before, and that grants you permission to do this. Well, so Artaud grants us permission to do many things, right? Because, like, oh, there's Artaud did it, and Artaud's famous. But then also there are those moments where you don't have a specific permission, and then as a rebellion against, I mean, any power structure. And so if we speak of a male-dominated patriarchal power structure, then, yeah, there is a difference between perhaps granting more permission to young male writers than to young female writers. But it's really the question of power structure. And then the question of the avant-garde always seems to be working against that power structure. And then I think in the question, there's the whole problem of the word gender, right? I don't know that we could get fewer than 10 meanings of what gender is from this group of people, right? It's one of those words like postmodernism that has so many different meanings. Anytime anybody says it, it's really problematic. I mean, for me, I see gender as a structure imposed upon people by society, right? So that in certain cultures, men wear skirts. And in certain other cultures, men don't. And in each culture, gender is determined by what the culture is and what, you know, is culturally acceptable. So we put in the question of gender, it becomes problematic. But the question of permission, I think, is kind of clear. And I think that each of the four of you spoke about the question of permission and how, you know, the writing, Joan's writing, grants you specific moments of permission. So that's just a thought.
I just want to say that it's very odd to say that we can't talk about gender in a women's panel here about women's poetry. I think we should give ourselves permission.
I wasn't saying we can't speak about it. I was saying that if we speak about it, we're going to end up with a lot of different definitions and a lot of different misunderstandings.
But excuse me, what we're having here is a discussion about Joan Retallack and about this book, which deals with feminism and women's issues.
I'm going to break out the term permission more rather than gender, because I don't want to define gender right now. just because I'm going to open up permission to amplification more. I mean, one thing I can speak of out of my identity here is that it's been very hard to be heard and seen. And I think there's this feeling of impermanence. And one reason that Jen and I decided to do this was because we wanted to get down in print, even in stone would have even been lovelier, the thoughts and context of a lot of writers, feminist writers, who we felt would fade away the way that we could feel many woman-identified writers fading away quickly and not being heard. And this is in a lot of arenas. I mean, I used to work in a kind of corporate atmosphere, and it's well documented that in a meeting, when you speak in a higher voice, your observations are not going to be heard, but are going to be repeated in a deep male voice, and then that's slow. So I think that's what I feel more of permission is, amplification, and then also just seeing written out on a page the exterior of my internal thinking of a poet. It's just when I read that paragraph on fractals and coastlines, it was like, it's like being turned inside out, and just having that amplification. And maybe resonance is another kind of word. So I'm going to invite more of the audience. Oh, Erica.
I would I
would kind of build on that and add, like, if I think about the space of Belladonna, I mean, that was a space that was, you know, initially started by Rachel Levitsky, and then I joined forces with her. And, you know, and Susan's work was instrumental to this, but, you know, we were creating a certain kind of feminist space that didn't exist before. At least that was when I was kind of emerging into that, to that organization, I suppose. You know, I had not been in a space for poetry that was articulating itself as a feminist space or even as a queer space. When I think about the word permission, I mean, I think that, first of all, like, for me, you know, the question of feminism is one that I think about constantly. It drives my work. It's something that I think a lot about. The word permission for me is more tied to class. So when I'm using it in the context of class and work, and as somebody who, you know, has a lot of questions about my own sort of ability to participate in certain spaces purely because I don't have, you know, the same kind of history as others who might be in those spaces, not to be super vague. I mean, for me, permission is just so tied up for that. And, you know, I remember reading Joan's work, you know, it was a model for me. And it kind of turned on a light bulb, and then reading The Poethical Wager in Joan's essays offered me a different way of thinking about what it meant to actually make prose, or what it meant to embark upon an essay. And even like what it means to ask a good question, like that all sort of...
If I could add, that's really what I was trying to say, and I guess failed. What I meant by permission in the through the prism of Joan's work is the difference between asking questions and providing answers.
No, I was just going to say that the space of Belladonna, the work of Joan, Rachel Levitsky, I think to me these feminist avant-garde spaces, what they have done to me is it's I don't just have to be a pupil, although I am that also, I'm learning and receiving, but it's dialogical, it's generative, it's there is self-awareness of the writer. It's inviting me and others as a reader to come in and do some work. And so in the beginning, a lot of Joan's work, she'll say, like, I have some questions. I don't, you know, we'll see where they go. It's not like just this diatribe. So to me, that's like the fundamental thing that I get and still get and make these spaces very special. Yeah.
And if I could just add one more person to our list, I just want to name Susan B. and Meaning.
Yes.
As another important
yes.
formative contribution.
Absolutely. Yes.
I'll just ask about, you've all talked a lot about how you've been able to find yourselves and find your voice and have felt your voices amplified and your thinking amplified through Joan's work. But so much about Joan's work is also about decentering, about being othered, you know, and so can you talk a little bit more about just like how that process of decentering and othering is part of your own process of finding yourself?
Just thinking about that for a few minutes.
Yeah.
I'm going to answer that as an eco poet. that the question of relating as human to outside human, and there's no good term for saying non-human. Like, I don't want to talk about what's around me and the non-human and how we have no idea really where we fit as a species. There's this continual process of decentering and questioning your placement in this species body in relation to what's around you that doesn't resemble your own species. And that's really hard. I mean, there's this scale, always this question of scale, how not to be a nature poet. You know? I guess that's where in Joan's work I found a lot of support, is how to also bring in the science, bring in fractals, bring that into aesthetic realm of my work. because I very much want to keep the aesthetic sense of that too, and to play with that. So that's just my own personal unothering.
I think, you know, to emphasize the ethics side of the term poetics is it's really it's not just self and others, but it's like a network of apparent othering that we, like the world we live in, right, is actually this endless network of relationship, power dynamics. I mean, I do think that any analysis of trying to be within a power dynamic, one aspect of it has something to offer to everyone because we're all in layered power dynamics, all of us. But I think just, or I see that fundamental question of poetics really is about the relation of word to world. And you're already decentered, you know, because you have to question word from a multiplicity of worlds. And there's a big response, or I always feel there's a responsibility, a good responsibility that Joan puts forward. You have to question that a lot to never kind of coagulate into a quick no, which is just another trap. But it's a difficult task, but I think an exciting one. And hopefully it means our work is connected to worldliness, which I think is just incredibly important. You know, that experimental work not be seen as some internal. I think the game and the play is there too, but that's connected to this ethical exploration. It's maybe kind of an answer.
I echo what Evelyn says.
Yeah, I will just say that I think when we're talking, I feel like about finding ourselves, it actually contains this idea of otherness. It's not, we're not really speaking about it from like a purely lit romantic, like finding ourselves, which I think you know, but it's really just like using Joan's work or dialogue with Joan's work as a way to find ourselves in a very large way and our open our perception and attention to others. Like that's part of the finding yourselves, is to realize like it's not about just this, it's about like reaching outward and growing from that and seeing what both your poetics is available, which is everything else is available, teaching, you know, ethics, all that. So I think that's what we're talking about here.
So I just did a little time check, and I think I'm going to call close to this section so that we have some time to enjoy the bounty of value print wonderful books and talk to Joan.